Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. 5 months into the COVID pandemic, small businesses and sole proprietors are struggling to stay afloat. There are 31 million small businesses in the U.S. Last year, they employed nearly half of the private workforce and created 1.6 million jobs. As COVID surges in many states across the country, so many small businesses still cannot reopen. Some have no choice but to close for good. According to Yelp, nearly 66,000 small businesses have closed since March, but researchers say that number is likely much higher. Harvard researchers estimate that nearly 110,000 small businesses shut down permanently between March and early May. Here in the Bay Area, the publication Eater is tracking dozens of restaurants and cafes that have permanently closed. Gonzalo Guzman closed his popular restaurant Nopalito in the Inner Sunset for good just a few weeks ago. He told the San Francisco Chronicle, "I'm going to miss the neighborhood and the community we built while working there." The Paycheck Protection Program, which has been extended to August 8th, was supposed to help small businesses. But many business owners who received loans say there's no guarantee their business will survive. The PPP has given out over $518 billion. According to a recent survey from the National Federation of Independent Businesses, more than half of small companies that got loans say they've already spent all of that money. Well, joining us to talk about this is David Dayan, executive editor of The American Prospect. David's first book, Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, won the Studs and Ida Terkel Prize. His new book is Monopolized, Life in the Age of Corporate Power. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to the show. Congratulations on your new book, and we'd love to have you on to talk about it.
I'd be happy to do that, but happy to talk about small businesses today. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. And Dave, before we talk about small businesses, I just wanted to provide an update on what's happening to that $600 a week in unemployment benefits, because that expires this weekend. We did a show about it yesterday. We got so many emails and phone calls from people saying, if this thing expires, they have no idea how they're going to make ends meet. So have you been following the latest? Yesterday, CNBC reported that Republicans wanted to bring down the amount to $400 a month. At first, I thought that was a mistake. I thought it's got to be a week, but it's not. It's a month. But still, we just don't have any official plan yet.
I think everybody thought it was a mistake. It is a mistake.
Right.
So today, Secretary Mnuchin went on CNBC, and he was a little vague, but what he said is that they would extend the program so that it replaces 70% of working wages. Now, it's unclear what that means in terms of the cut from the $600 a month benefit. The whole reason that it was a flat benefit is that these antiquated unemployment systems throughout the states could not say, okay, we're going to give you the same amount of money that you had when you were working. So we'll just give you $600 a month, which is supposed to target the median income and be 100% replacement rate. Mnuchin now is talking about 70% replacement rate, so that is definitely a cut. How much of a cut is unclear. It doesn't seem as extreme as $100 a week or $400 a month, but it could be $200 a week. It could be 250. It's somewhere in between 200 and 400. Now, of course, this is just the Republican bill, right? House Democrats passed a bill extending the $600 through the end of the year. So now there's going to be a negotiation. I mean, the big problem is that this expires this week. This is the last week that people will see that $600 in their paycheck. And if they don't come to a decision soon in Congress, that's just going to expire. And the real fear is that these state systems will have problems shutting it off and then having to shut it back on again. and making sure everyone gets what they're entitled to. So it's a really drastic situation, and obviously it's inadequate. If you're talking about cutting, it's like cutting a salary by 50% or 60% all at one time. What is that going to do to the economy?
Right. And rent is due next Saturday. The federal eviction moratorium ends on Friday, and millions of renters are at risk.
Yeah, absolutely. It's that's a whole other aspect to this. This is why we're calling it the cliff. It's not just unemployment benefits, but it's rentals. And the most recent survey from the Census Bureau shows that 26% of renters either have missed a payment or are not confident about making their next payment. Mm. So that's one in four in the country who have this insecurity about rent, and now they don't have the federal protection, and in many states, the state-based moratoria are starting to expire or already have expired. So it's a very concerning situation.
Exactly, and it really is just piecemeal policies. Yesterday, there was some news. I just want to share this in case people didn't see this. The Oakland side reports that Alameda County has extended its eviction moratorium through September 30th. Mm-hmm. So at this point, I mean, if you're having a hard time paying rent, you need to find out what's going on at your local level and at your state level. According to CBS, 12 million renters could lose their home. David, again, the Democrats want to extend the $600 in weekly unemployment benefits. The Democrats also want to extend this eviction moratorium. And I mean, we don't have time here. What are you hearing on Capitol Hill?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Mitch McConnell had 2 months after the House Democrats' offer, the HEROES Act, passed to come up with something. And they waited up until Thursday, the day before the last business day before the unemployment expires, to come to even a tentative agreement among Republicans. So they still have to go back to the Democrats and start the negotiations. It's a crime that these negotiations haven't even started yet between Democrats and Republicans. People are on the brink here. They're waiting to see what's going to happen. And they're not being well served by their government. And we need a lot more attention paid to what's happening in Washington right now.
Right. Well, if you have a story to share about, you know, what's going to happen if you lose that $600 in benefits, you can give us a call. We'd also love to hear from you if you are a small business owner or a sole proprietor. And also if you work for a small business, because if small businesses shut down, so many people are going to lose their jobs. I mean, as we said in the intro, let's see, last year, small businesses employed nearly half of the private workforce and created 1.6 million jobs. So if you have a story to share, if you have resources to share, if you have any questions, give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. So, David, we've had you on a couple times talking about the Paycheck Protection Program. It received a lot of criticism from the very beginning. The first round of loans ran out after 2 weeks. So many large businesses with over 500 employees sucked up so many of those loans. Can you just take us back and talk about what the PPP was supposed to do?
Well, I mean, that's kind of the problem. we don't really know what it was supposed to do. I mean, we know that there was this program that smaller businesses with under 500 employees, there was a sort of caveat to that that you just alluded to, but we'll get to that later, were supposed to be able to apply for this, and it would cover 8 weeks of payroll for their employees, and then there'd be a small portion left over that could cover overhead expenses or other issues that businesses might have had during this crisis. And the first round, as you said, got snapped up very quickly. They ended up approving a second round of funding, which has not moved very quickly at all. And, you know, it expired on June 30th, and then there's this extension made until August 8th. But when it expired on June 30th, $521 billion had been approved for the program. It is now July 23rd, and $518 billion has been approved for the program. So a negative $3 billion has been appropriated in 3 weeks out of this program. And so what that says is that this is not really being used anymore. It's just being, you know, having money returned by people who were large corporations or tied to private equity firms or whatever, and they decided this isn't worth it and we're going to return the money. That's all that's happening in the program right now. And there are a lot of reasons for that. Number one, you know, if you wait this long to get a loan and you're a real small business in need, you probably aren't in business anymore. So we've seen, as you mentioned before, hundreds of thousands of businesses go out, and people just could not wait and hold out that long. Before the crisis began, J.P. Morgan did a study that showed that most small businesses have about 2 weeks of reserves available to them. And by the time the second round of funding came out, it was 2 months since the start of the coronavirus crisis. So that was one problem. There's no demand there because the businesses are going away. The second problem is that the way it was structured, as I just explained to you, to give 8 weeks of a pass-through to payrolls and just a little bit left for sustaining the business, that was really not useful to a lot of businesses, especially ones like in San Francisco, in high-rent areas where rent is a significant portion of your overhead costs. It just didn't make sense to a lot of businesses to do this because it wasn't going to help them survive. So the combination of those factors, and then the third factor is that this wasn't delivered by the government, right? It was delivered through private banks. And the banks, that particularly the large banks, were kind of self-interested about it. They said only our clients can apply. They pushed through larger loans to businesses that they could establish a client relationship with and sell them other products. So they got a concierge service, it was called. They got in the front of the line. And the small businesses that really needed it were sort of left behind, especially if they didn't have a client relationship with a bank, if they never had to borrow money before or anything like that. Community banks, oddly enough, did much better with this program, which kind of raises the question of why we need big banks to begin with. If they can't make loans, what are they supposed to be doing? But all of those factors have led to the fact that this program provided a little bit of support for businesses that were going to keep people on the payroll already and gave them a little bit of liquidity during this difficult time. But it doesn't appear to have prevented a lot of layoffs, and now it doesn't appear to be preventing a lot of closures of businesses.
According to a recent piece from NBC, of the 5 million businesses that got loans, 4 million were only for less than $150,000. So what does that tell us?
Well, it tells us that a great deal of what we call small businesses are actually sole proprietors. Mm-hmm. They're you know, individuals who run a business out of their house, or who run, you know, whether it's a local printing business or an accounting business or things like that. And so a lot of these loans are micro loans. We focus on, you know, the big ones that went to places like Ruth's Chris Steakhouse or the L.A. Lakers, but that is a relatively small proportion of the overall loans. As you said, 86% of them were for $150,000 or less. You know, it probably helped those companies to some degree, but, you know, this was all predicated on this being an eight-week crisis. We're going to give you 8 weeks of payroll. This is a bridge to a brighter moment in the future when your employees can come back to work and you're going to get all the business back that you had before the crisis. Well, we're well past 8 weeks, right? I mean, you know, that would have taken us from March to May. And here we are in late July with, in California, more cases than ever. And so that was the problem. The design was not, it was not robust enough to actually keep these businesses afloat.
We also have been talking about how this was handled in Europe. And the New York Times had a piece a couple weeks ago, a European workers draw paychecks, American workers scrounge for food. I mean, what a headline. Yeah. In the pandemic, the United States has relied on expanded unemployment benefits while European governments have subsidized wages, avoiding a surge in joblessness. And I think this is important to talk about because what happened was in Europe, the governments provided about 70% to 85% of small business wages, which is the complete opposite of what happened here in the United States.
Yeah, it is important to discuss because, you know, there were kind of two ways to do this, right? So one was, let's just cover everybody's payroll. Let's you know, when your payroll company distributes the money to the various workers, they can just bill the government for it. And that's how they did it in Europe in many countries. And, you know, Denmark, for example, went from 4% unemployment to 4.2% because they covered all the payroll through the government. So that's one way to do it. The other way is sort of to induce mass unemployment. And that's what we ended up doing to a large degree in America. We moved people to unemployment, and we put a pretty robust boost to unemployment in there such that a lot of people, particularly at the low end, the low-wage workers, were getting more in unemployment than they get in their normal paycheck. And of course, what does that speak to? It speaks to the inadequacy of their normal paycheck, not necessarily the generosity of unemployment. So, you know, given those factors and given that unemployment was, relatively speaking, pretty generous in the United States, you have to sort of choose which are you going to do. Are you going to keep businesses whole and keep people on payrolls? Or are you going to push people onto unemployment so they can stay home for the duration of the crisis? You know, it's an interesting philosophical kind of argument. If you believe that we have too many low-wage jobs in this country, the idea of keeping people on the payroll of those low-wage jobs might not be as appealing as putting people on unemployment where they're getting more money, at least temporarily, and it might be a spur to bargain for them, to bargain for better wages at their various businesses. So we've actually ran a debate at the Prospector about this. You know, Pramila Jayapal, the congresswoman from Washington State, put out a bill to do this kind of universal payroll support, and so she took that side of the argument. We had some researchers that took the enhanced unemployment is a good thing, and it builds worker power. So we had that side of the argument. So you can argue it both ways. The problem is that both are running out. You know, the meager payroll support that we did for only a small subset of businesses has already been exhausted, and the boosted unemployment is going to exhaust in a matter of days. And so the problem is that both of them were inadequate, and it looks like whatever Congress is going to come up with is going to continue to be inadequate.
Today we're speaking with David Dayan, executive editor of the American Prospect and author of the new book, Monopolized, Life in the Age of Corporate Power. Today we are talking about how small businesses will get through COVID. According to Yelp, 66,000 small businesses have already closed. Harvard researchers say the number is probably 110,000. If you have a story to share, if you have questions about resources, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. The New York Times recently ran a piece called I Can't Keep Doing This, and they interviewed a sports bar owner in Texas, Nick Mascari. He took the PPP money to stay afloat during the spring lockdown, but then when Texas had to close again, he decided to close for good. He said he still owes the bank $80,000, the money that he used to open the restaurant, because it is so expensive to get everything ready, you know, especially if you have to, if you're in like a nail salon, there's all that plastic. It costs a lot to get things ready. And then food, for example, goes bad if you have to close again. So what's going to happen to these business owners who are already in debt?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very clear that the only way to truly fix the economy is to stop the pandemic. And we can keep giving money and you know, establishing these programs, but if you don't fix the pandemic, then ultimately there's little opportunity for businesses that are consumer facing, you know, these businesses like restaurants and anything that has a large gathering around it, it's impossible for them to stay in business and survive. And having them stop and start, as you just said, is worse than just having them locked down for as long as needed and then return. That's why, you know, it was a big problem for these states to reopen prematurely. And one of the factors of that is the fact that the CARES Act back in March did not give money to state and local governments to offset the losses in revenue that they were going to have from locking down. And that induced them to open prematurely. We actually have some data on that that we ran at the Prospect, political science data that shows that if you relied more on local revenue, on sales tax revenue or individual income tax revenue, you were more likely to reopen prematurely like we did here in California. And that created this resumption of the virus surge. And so really what we have to do is stop this virus. None of this is going to be fixed until then. And what you're talking about with regard to debt, I think what you're going to see is a tremendous number of elevated bankruptcies, small business bankruptcies in the United States. Which, you know, at least we have that option for some small businesses to, you know, have a new start and not be tied down with this debt forever. But it's an arduous process and a difficult process and a wrenching one if you, you know, sort of set up your life as someone who wanted to deliver your talents through a restaurant or through a retail store or something like that, and then you see it all go for nothing. This is also going to ruin the fabric of small towns and local cities and lead to a lot of more economic concentration at the retail level. It sort of gets into the themes of my book, but the pandemic is certainly going to consolidate and narrow our options even more.
Yeah, I've been following a lot of the exercise studios in San Francisco, the independent ones, and a number have already shut down, including Purusha Yoga. I just want to give a shout out to them. They're in the Richmond district. They have low cost yoga for people with PTSD, for veterans. I mean, these are, you know, community spaces that are so important to the city and to the neighborhoods, and they just can't survive, which is just so unfortunate for the communities that rely on these incredible spaces. We're going to take a quick break. David Dayan is executive editor of the American Prospect, author of the new book, Monopolized, Life in the Age of Corporate Power. And today we are talking about small businesses as COVID is surging 5 months after this started. How are small businesses going to survive? So many have already shut down for good. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
You are listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment on the website at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. remembering the legacy of two civil rights icons, C.T. Vivian and John Lewis, on 1A, 1/2 hour from now at 11 o'clock, right after your call.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll get an update on the COVID pandemic in Italy. They are doing so much better than they were a couple of months ago. We'll talk about the $860 billion recovery fund to help the EU tackle their economic crisis. And we will talk about a new McClatchy investigation about sexual assault and harassment in the U.S. Coast Guard. According to a survey published last July, almost half of female cadets in the Coast Guard Academy reported sexual harassment. So how is the Coast Guard responding? If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email us, yourcall@kalw.org. And if you are a small business owner, a sole proprietor, if you work for a small business, we'd love to hear from you. How are you doing right now? If there are any resources you'd like to share, if you have a PPP story, you can call 800-525-9917 or email yourcall@kalw.org. David Dayan is executive editor of the American Prospect and author of the new book, Monopolized, Life in the Age of Corporate Power. We will have David on in the coming weeks to talk about that. Now I would like to welcome Amanda Ballantyne to the show. Amanda is executive director of the Main Street Alliance. Since 2008, this organization has built a network of over 30,000 businesses in 11 states. They include restaurants, farmers, artists, and more. Hi, Amanda. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Well, Amanda, what are you hearing from some of your members, given that we're 5 months in and unfortunately we just don't see any end in sight right now?
There's a lot of concern in the small business community, to be sure. I think, you know, in the beginning of this crisis, we had a lot of questions about how long the pandemic would last. And, you know, our network was working very hard to convince the federal government, particularly, that we needed to pass long-term solutions and consider that this pandemic might be with us until there's a viable vaccine. And unfortunately, the surges that we've seen across many states and the resurgence of the vaccine in many states that look like they had it in control are suggesting that we're looking at a much longer time horizon, and that is causing just deep concern in impacted small businesses. Businesses that maybe managed to access some of the recovery programs and are now looking at the end of those benefits and really wondering what's next and wondering how long they can last.
What are some of the long-term solutions, well, that you wanted to see months ago, but that you still want to see?
I think it's important to think about the way that this crisis is going to be impacting different sort of geographic regions in our economy. As the virus sort of surges and then goes away. And so we have been advocating for long-term flexible relief programs, for example, payroll subsidies rather than like the payroll protection program, which is a loan that turns into a grant. So looking at really long-term payroll subsidies as a way of managing unemployment and creating the flexibility for business owners who may have to shut down for periods of time and then may be able to reopen. We've been looking specifically at equity issues because many small businesses of color, BIPOC-owned small businesses, were left out of the Paycheck Protection Program and haven't been able to access it. So how do we move money to those businesses effectively so we don't, you know, completely, really, I think we could lose major sectors of the BIPOC small business community. We've also been talking about what does reopening safely look like. In addition to advocating for, you know, healthcare access and masking policies, you know, we've been talking about why don't we have universal federal standards that are specific by industry for how to reopen under COVID and sort of create that certainty so that business owners have a roadmap and then fund business owners to make those safety retrofitting changes or to access PPP so that they can protect their employees and their customers. These are the types of policies that we need to see put in place that can be renewed and that can create sort of a predictable playing field for small businesses in a very unpredictable time.
Right. Because, Amanda, I've seen interviews with hairstylists, for example, or nail salon owners who say, you know, I'm trying to do the right thing, but this is expensive to buy the sanitizer, to buy the masks in the salons, to have plastic separators, for example. I mean, this all of this costs money.
And it's money that many of those business owners not only don't have because they haven't been able to operate for months,
right. But
it's also credit that they can't access because, you know, millions and millions of small business owners don't have adequate access to banking because of redlining in small business lending that's existed for generations. So there's a real equity issue for BIPOC owned small business owners in the service sector, but it's also true that every business owner that's customer facing in this country has to retrofit if it's going to continue operating, and whether that's just providing safety equipment for employees or whether it's actually changing the physical makeup of their restaurant or their store, you know, those are costs that are just increasingly out of reach because rent has been mounting. The cost of rental equipment has been mounting, and these fixed costs haven't many business owners haven't been able to pay these fixed costs, and they've been putting them off. So you're looking at a situation where business owners need to make dramatic changes in their business model and in the way that they physically operate their stores at the same time when debts from the past few months have been mounting. And it's we're looking at a perfect storm for business owners, especially with increasing consumer nervousness, both about the resurgence of the virus and about the potential cliff in unemployment benefits that we're looking at next week.
To that point, Dave, Vox had a piece yesterday called The End of the American Dream, and they report that despite a second round of PPP, hundreds of thousands of small businesses have yet to receive aid, especially mom and pops and small businesses that are owned by people of color. There have been a lot of stories about how many minority-owned businesses have been shut out and just don't have access to capital. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah.
So
it's
an acute crisis, I think, in for small business owners of color. Part of that is that the PPP was designed poorly, and the other part of that is it was rolled out in a very incompetent way. So the 95% of black-owned small businesses are sole proprietorships in the United States. 95% of Latinx-owned businesses are sole proprietorships, and I think 76% of Asian-owned small businesses. Asian American-owned small businesses in the United States are sole proprietorships. Those businesses weren't even allowed to apply for loans in the first couple weeks of the PPP program when all of the money in the first round of funding was taken. And you also have to understand that because the rules rolled out very slowly and in this haphazard way, most of the banks that were participating in the 7A SBA lending program that administered the Paycheck Protection Program were creating their own rules to decide which of their customers would get those loans. Maybe only extending those loans to existing customers, some only extending those loans to customers with existing open lines of credit. And the small business owners of color have always lacked access to traditional lending from private lending institutions. And this just made that crisis so much more acute at a moment when those smallest businesses were the most desperate for cash. So there's a University of California Santa Cruz professor, Robert Fairley, who's done some initial research. There's not a lot of data yet, but his projections show that probably almost 500,000 black-owned small businesses closed in the first few months of this crisis.
Half a million.
Yeah, his numbers say between 400 and 450. Oh, sorry, I'm 100,000. Half, yeah, 450,000 small businesses.
That is a huge number.
It's a huge number. And you know, it's like this crisis is impacting all small independent businesses, and it is just, it is stunning the impact on businesses owned by people of color.
I can add to that with something we learned today. There was an analysis of one of the larger banks, Wells Fargo's delivery of PPP loans. And, we only have the names of the recipients who got loans over $150,000. For Wells Fargo, they gave out over 12,000 of those loans, somewhat larger loans over $150,000. Only one of them went to a black-owned business. One out of 12,000. And this is indicative. As the other guest says, a lot of these black and Latino-owned businesses are are owned by people who are in sole proprietorships. They're well under that $150,000 level, and that just speaks to that. We're talking about entire neighborhoods that are going to struggle to have any local businesses in those communities, and what happens then is that chains come in, and the money, the wealth of those communities gets sucked up into corporate treasuries that are far away from that community, and it makes it hard for money to circulate within those communities and for those communities to thrive. So it's a serious problem, no matter what the community, but the disproportionate impact is on those Black and Latino communities.
That's absolutely right. And as the crisis continues, the fixed costs for all of these entrepreneurs are mounting. And, you know, I think there have already been waves of business closures. I think that the other guest was absolutely right. We'll see a wave of bankruptcies. And what that means when we know that private equity firms have been amassing capital for years waiting for a next economic downturn is that private equity will step in and purchase the high-value rent in cities, and we'll see gentrification increase tremendously. So I think what's happening in the small business community, it certainly has impacts on small business owners, many of whom have leveraged their business against their personal assets, like their home or their car or other personal assets that they have. You know, so there's small business owners, their employees, their personal wealth. And then there's also just a question of what happens to our cities through this crisis and through this upheaval. And so I think you start to see the way that this, what's happening in the small business community, has implications for all of us.
Right, and we've already been seeing it over the last couple decades. To add to the points that you both made, Color of Change pulled 500 Black and Latino small business owners from April 30th to May 11th, found that just 1 in 10 received the PPP funding they requested. Half said they might not be able to last the next 6 months.
Right.
Well, if you are in San Francisco and you are a Black small business owner or a Black entrepreneur, just a couple days ago, there's a new program that was launched from Give2SF. Loans of up to $50,000 with 0% interest are available. The application period is open until August 4th, and you can go to sfaacc.org for more information, sfaacc.org. We also have other resources for small business owners on our resource page at kalw.org. Today, we are talking about small businesses and how they're managing to survive. Many have not survived, and many will most likely shut down in the coming months. David Dane is executive editor of The American Prospect and author of a book that is very much connected to what we're talking about, Monopolized: Life in the Age of Corporate Power. We will have him on soon to talk about that. Amanda Ballantine is executive director of the Main Street Alliance, and you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We've got a number of emails. Mira wrote in and she said, I wanted to send you an email I sent you back in April of 2018. Small businesses like ours were suffering well before the COVID situation, mainly due to the radical inequality in the economy related to tech monopoly capitalism. Businesses like Sightglass Cafe do fine because they're backed by Jack Dorsey at Twitter. They have endless cash supplies, but little places like ours cannot make it. The costs are too high. We're only able to stay open because my husband and I have a rent-controlled apartment, and our landlord at the cafe is not a sociopathic capitalist and gives us breaks on the rent. They also happen to be one of the last African-American property owners in Hayes Valley. Dave, I'm sure you touch on this in your new book.
Well, there actually is a moment in the book where I'm in San Francisco and I'm waiting for a bus, and I turn around and I see that I am right in front of Bank of America Plaza at Zuckerberg General Hospital. And I think that kind of says it all about the how San Francisco has become this sort of city of monopolies, sort of lifted on the backs of these giant platform companies. The author is correct. The writer of the email This has already been a struggling situation for small businesses. You know, if you talk to members of Congress, you'll hear a lot of praise for small businesses as the backbone of America or whatever. But when it comes down to it, the agency at the federal level that serves small businesses, Small Business Administration, is seen as one of the less effective agencies within the federal government. The benefits that small business owners get are relatively limited, and the benefits that large businesses have been able to achieve, not only historically, but in this crisis, where they're able to tap a $4.5 trillion Federal Reserve money cannon, this huge bazooka of money, and they have benefited from the halo effect of the Fed saying, we will do whatever it takes to help small or help big businesses by, you know, we've seen the stock market soar and the ability to lend at the corporate level for large businesses become very, very achievable while these small businesses suffer. I mean, we just see this inequality through the response to the pandemic in addition to throughout our society at large. And, you know, I think that's great what you talked about with this program in San Francisco about interest-free loans, but ultimately loans can't replace income. The only way that we're going to see small businesses thrive is if revenues come back, and the only way to do that is to stop the pandemic.
Right. And Dave, we're also going to have to have you on again. Well, maybe when we bring you on to talk about your book, to talk about just how out of control the stock market is. I mean, Amazon is trading at just over $3,000 a share, which is
a staggering number, which is on Monday, big tech stocks increased their market value by $281 billion. That was just on Monday. And I'm talking about Amazon, Google, Facebook, Apple, Tesla, and Netflix. That's all. Mm-hmm. Just six stocks. So that's what we're dealing with, is that this pandemic is accelerating a concentration of corporate power throughout our economy.
Right, and widening inequality. Well, thank you for calling in, Mira. Thank you so much for sharing your story. Let's go to a caller. Let's hear from Tom in San Francisco.
Hello. I just wanted to amplify and support the woman from Hayes Valley who's really struggling and sees the connection with tech money. I'm a business owner of Nomadic Coffee, where I'm the founder and built it up from nothing, but did it with no tech money and no money really. And I think as a strategy, I split ownership. So now we have multiple owners, and that sort of co-op model, I think, is a way to, you know, put your head to the wind together and find support, you know, mutual support as owners, to kind of weather the storm. But I really share the frustration and anger at the tech money that supports businesses and makes it look like, wow, how come we're not doing as good as them? But in reality, you know, we're a real business trying to make real money and survive, really. So that's all. That's my comment.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for calling in, Thomas, to share your story. We're going to take a few more calls and emails, and then we'll get responses from our guests. Let's hear from Jen in Pleasanton. Hi, Jen. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Go ahead. You're on the air.
So I am, my name is Jen Hatcher. I'm a hairstylist and a small business owner in downtown Pleasanton. Our salon has been closed since mid-March. Alameda County, obviously, is one that hasn't made any movement towards reopening, and there was an announcement this week that some portions of our services could be offered outside, which, aside from being impractical at best, is really insulting to our industry. Just from a financial perspective, haircuts alone are 15% of my business, if that. And so for unemployment to now be not an option for people in my industry and people in my perspective, by offering this kind of a Band-Aid on a bullet hole solution, is financially devastating. It's incredible. It's incredible that this is the offer that we're getting. So the salon that I work with and work for, we hosted a rally yesterday at the health department in Oakland, and we got some great news coverage on it, and we're really hoping to continue the conversation and kind of open the eyes of the people who are making these decisions that we are a sanitary business, and as unessential as we seem on paper, we need to be reconsidered.
Jen, can I ask you, I mean, the beauty industry is just so big across this country. So many small businesses run nail salons, hair salons. A lot of people are employed by these businesses. What are you hearing from, you know, people who do nails, people who cut hair? How are they surviving right now?
Barely, truly. I mean, by the skin of our teeth, the CARES Act, there's an additional amount due to COVID that was added every week to unemployment, and that runs out August 1st. And after that, the numbers are they're not sustainable. And many, I mean, every single stylist that I work with, we're all moms. We're all providing for our family, and we're not being given many options on how to continue doing that. It feels like our portion of this industry has been forgotten, truly, and miscategorized.
Wow. Well, thank you for sharing, Jen. You know, we'll continue to do stories about this and keep you and your colleagues in mind, because, I mean, this is just so difficult for, you know, people who work in the beauty industry. Thank you so much for calling in. I want to read just a couple more emails, and then we will get a response from our guests. Let's see. Margaret writes in, I am one of those sole proprietors who started a minimal claim for unemployment just before COVID. I was laid off from a small weekly job and was eligible for $150 a week. After COVID started, I wasn't allowed to submit a new unemployment claim as a sole proprietor. I was grateful for the additional $600, but would have liked the higher weekly benefit I would have been eligible for. The only upside is that with my reduced income, my daughter is now eligible for Medi-Cal, saving me $400 a month. We also have an email from Suzanne, who says, when the $600 boost is gone, my husband and I, who live in Fairfax, will not be able to keep supporting the local places we patronize. I worry the small restaurants like the Hummingbird and Village Steak will not survive. I mean, this is just full circle in many ways when you think about it, Amanda, because so many of us love supporting our small businesses, and it's a trickle effect. If the $600 unemployment goes away, that's going to stop. And then, you know, if there's no additional support for the small businesses, I mean, there's so many layers to this.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And I think Republican leadership in Congress is really playing chicken with everyone. And, you know, they're pushing for a set of priorities that are not aligned with the pocketbooks of people who've been financially devastated, whether they're small business owners or whether they're just community members who've lost their jobs and are completely reliant not just on unemployment but also those emergency benefits. Because remember, unemployment is not a 100% reimbursement for lost wages when you're laid off. It's between 40% and 60% of lost wages in most states. So if the Republicans allow that emergency benefit to lapse, or if they cut it, it will be a dramatic constriction in consumers' ability to participate in the economy or even stay in their homes. So you're right, it creates this sort of wave of disruption that will crash back and forth across our economy. And I think it's really irresponsible for Republicans not to be putting out a plan to renew those benefits immediately so that people can rely and make plans and know that they're not going to be struggling to stay in their homes. You know, I think just waiting until the last minute and demanding tort reform and forcing schools to open when we know the virus is surging, that seems to be the Republican agenda right now. And it's very, very concerning.
Well, given where we are, Amanda, we don't see any end in sight with COVID. I mean, in fact, some cities are now talking about doing lockdowns again. At this point, what other solutions would you like to see? We have about a minute left.
Yeah. I mean, I think the first thing is we need to pass a program like the Paycheck Security Act, which is sponsored by Mark Warner and Senator Sanders. That would essentially allow people to reconnect with their jobs and get their payroll covered, so they would come off unemployment and be connected to their jobs, and they could. That would allow employers to open and close flexibly. Work sharing is another option. We also need to actually provide direct subsidies for small business owners to cover fixed costs like rent and personal protective equipment and safety retrofitting. We also need a comprehensive approach to addressing the pandemic and getting it in hand, like we've seen in Europe and Asian countries. We can control the virus if we have federal action now, but money needs to be made available for states to do that. And without a comprehensive long-term agenda, our economy will continue to struggle and suffer. And the inequality that your callers and your other guests have talked about will become more acute. So now is the time, and I think that there's still time to rein this in. But it needs to be a serious, comprehensive, and long-term response.
David, what would you add? We have about a minute left.
Yeah, I mean, Amanda really summed it up. I also think that, in the long term, we have to get better access to capital for small businesses, for them to sustain themselves. They probably are going to need more grants in the short term rather than loans or very long-dated loans, so they don't have to pay them back right away. And we might need some wage insurance and wage subsidies for workers, as well as some sort of national safety standard to get us through until such time as we have a vaccine that's widely distributed. This is a real crunch time for small businesses and for our country, and Congress needs to step up to the plate.
David Dayan is executive editor of the American Prospect and author of the new book, Monopolized, Life in the Age of Corporate Power. David, thanks for your work. Thanks for joining us, and we'll have you back soon.
Yeah, look for him to come back. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Amanda Ballantyne is executive director of the Main Street Alliance. They're a network of over 30,000 businesses in 11 states. Amanda, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Thank you, you too. You can find resources at yourcallradio.org, also at kalw.org. If you are located in the Bay Area, we've got resources for small businesses. And thank you so much for all of the emails and the phone calls. We will definitely continue to follow this issue. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance and Damian Miner for keeping the studio running. And I also wanted to give you an update about the violent crackdown that is happening in Portland. It continued last night. In fact, the mayor of Portland was tear gassed. Yesterday, the Trump administration announced that they are going to send federal agents to Kansas City, Albuquerque, and Chicago. And so next week, we are going to speak with community activists on the ground in those cities. If you have any guest ideas, please email yourcall@kalw.org. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be talking about the pandemic in Italy. We will also talk about a new McClatchy report about sexual harassment in the U.S. Coast Guard. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.